accession number 18463, reel 29.
About reel 29.
I could see the doctors down the end of the ward. There was a little sort of station down there. I presume they had a nursing orderly there all night. All males, of course, not a female nursing orderly. And I could see them looking at the, holding the slides up to the light and looking at them and shaking their heads and chatting and pointing down to me. And I thought, oh, God, I'm not going to get out of here. So eventually they must have decided that I was, you know, I was reasonably okay. And we got put on a, I guess it was a 1500, but I can't really remember what it was, and taken off quite a long way to an American hospital. And this was, again, they were always in great hollows, these hospitals, you know, with high hills all around them. Tented hospital, vast place it was. Now I do know how. We got off, went into reception where there was a rifle rack, wooden rifle rack, and you put your weapons in the rifle rack. And then there was a counter where they sort of checked you in and what have you. But in our case, and we could see through a blanket door, we could see loads and rows of beds, empty beds incidentally, and there were no casualties in there at all. And in fact, we'd been discharged from the Indian Field Ambulance early because they told us that the brigade was about to suffer quite a number of casualties, they expected, and they wanted to clear the ward to get us out, so they were sending us on to an American hospital. And a wooden seat there, just inside the door, facing the... And we were told to sit down there. And nothing happened. The doctor came out and looked at us, looked at our papers, went away, never spoke. There were a number of American nurses there, around all the time. Never spoke, never said a word, never gave us a cup of coffee, meal, or anything at all. We were there about, I'd guess, 4, 5, 6 hours, and we were beginning to think that they obviously, well, they didn't want us, they wanted to get shot of us. But they were so unfriendly, and an American soldier was brought in. I think he'd been in a road accident or something like that. It didn't look like a battle wound or anything. He'd hurt his leg and what have you. And all these nurses came out, fell out all over him and chatted to him and, you know, pucked him up and carted him off into the back of the hospital and totally ignored us. And we had two Argyles and two Middlesex, one support company and me from B Company. And of course, the Argyles were saying, well, we could do with a bit of this, I don't mind this. But so by this time, of course, they'd begin to change their minds. And then we heard a lorry, after about 6 hours, a lorry backed up to the door. And in came, there might have been two lorries for all I know, but they backed up and we were called out. The Middlesex chaps called out. Could have been the Argyles as well, I can't remember. And we were just sent off. I presume there was some documentation, I mean, I never saw it, and maybe the driver had it, I can't tell. Went off back to, B Echelon and HQ Company were together at this time, or maybe it was the forward echelon, the one or the other, and they were camped well back, and we were told that the battalion was still up in the hills. And we were supposed to stay with them for, I think it was 10 days, on sort of light duties, and they gave us a 3-ton truck to use as their accommodation, empty 3-ton truck, and we got some blankets and what have you, but it's about the worst place in the world to sleep because it's got a metal floor and the coal comes out from underneath. And I'll be honest, I don't think they didn't make us very much at home there, because, and you don't, I mean, this is a fact of life. You live in your own little platoon community, you know everybody, and everybody else is a stranger, and I suppose if you stay there long enough you become one of them. But after 3 days, on the third day, I thought, I've had enough of this. I said to the other chap, the support company chap, I said, I'm going to go back up the battalion if I can. He said, well, you're a fool, you should serve your 10 days here doing nothing. So I went and saw the CSM, and he was a older fatherly sort of chap, and I said to him, look, can I go back up the battalion? And he said, well, you're not supposed to. You're supposed to be here for 10 days. I mean, you know, you haven't got anywhere near that yet. But I said, well, I really would like to go. I mean, I'm desperate to get back up there again. And they're short-handed, of course, as well, with anybody away. So he said, all right, I'll take you in front of the company commander. And he, again, was a... I didn't know him by name. I know his name now, but I didn't know it then. And he took me in front of the company commander, and he did this. He said the same thing. You shouldn't really go. You know, you're supposed, we're supposed to hold you here for 10 days, and you've only done three, two and a half as it happens. But I said, well, I'm desperate to get back up the company. And he said, well, I'll tell you what I do. Your colour sergeant is about half a mile down the road. He's got a little base there where he's taking the rations up each day to the company. If you want to go up with him, you can. But if he has to move, you'll have to come back with us again. And I was as happy as a little soundboy, to be honest. I sort of ran back, I think, to get my kit together, and I said to the chap, I'm going back up the battalion. He said, you're a BF. That's all I can say about you. And but I didn't care, I was off. And I went down the road and found them. And they were in a little gully. Albert Critchley, of course, a colour sergeant, Albert Critchley, and my old friend, who'd been the platoon commander after Gus was killed. And, of course, we're amongst friends again now. And we laid on the side of the road. They had a great big pile of rations there, and each day they went off up to battalion, or to the company, in actual fact, of course, and dish out the rations. There must have been other colour sergeants around there, but I didn't actually see them. I wasn't very interested in them. And I think it was two or three days, I can't really remember. And I'd said to Albert that when you eventually close on the battalion, I can come with you. There's no problem there. I've been told I can come up with you. I hadn't, of course. I've been told to go back to HQ company. But, of course, he was a bit of a wily old bird, and he naturally had been back and asked the CSM and found out that wasn't quite true. He never told me this, of course. So I'm living there in ignorance, thinking that when he moves, I'll move with him. And it was a very nasty incident here now. Couple of the HQ company lads came back on a jeep. I knew these two, and went off down to HQ company and called over a chap who was with us. He wasn't from our company. I don't know really what he was. An older reservist, and apparently they'd found a house with a young 13-year-old girl there, and they were dashing off to rape her, quite frankly. And they went off, and you thought, well, how can I stop them? You can't stop them, because they're nothing whatsoever to do with you. You can deal with your own platoon, you can deal with it. There's no problem whatsoever. But anybody outside your own platoon, maybe even in your own company, you could do it. And these weren't anything to do with us. And they went off, and about an hour later, they came back, full of themselves. A terrible situation. But I guess this was happening all over Korea. And funny enough, the Korean people didn't seem to concern them quite so much as it would have done us, perhaps. And that was a very nasty incident. I wasn't very happy about that at all. And we heard about that time. I heard from Albert that there had been an incident whilst they were out at rest, where a party, there had been a South Korean party there of officers and nurses, the nurses again, of course, you know, the maybe nurses, baby don't. And somebody had gone down, and it ended up, quite frankly, there'd been a confrontation there, and a grenade had been thrown into the house. Some of the officers and some of the nurses killed. And when the police, you know, the RMPs came along, I suppose it was special police came along, they'd found a Middlesex badge, so they knew that a Middlesex chap was involved, and he had been arrested. Two of them had been arrested, and a number of Canadians. Because the Canadians, also at this rest camp, had been brewing up. We used to have little canisters which you could heat up in the bottom of your trench and heat just about enough to heat a tin of food up on, which had only just recently been issued. We'd never had them before. But they were wood alcohol, and the Canadians had got this out and brewed it up with orange juice. And I can't remember how many there were. A lot of them went blind, a great number of them went blind, temporary blindness. But six or seven of them died. And we heard later that their CO had got these dead bodies, propped them up on stretchers, and marched the battalion past them and said, look, this is what happens when you're stupid. But unfortunately, of course, I guess air chaps have perhaps been on this alcohol stuff as well. I knew one of them. I didn't know the other, but I knew one of them, and I knew he was a rather strange fellow, unusual fellow. And they were taken off and court-martialed and sent to DB, I presume. I never heard any more of them then or since. Anyway, Albert's now got an order to go forward the following morning. He's got to go and join the company. He's come down out the hills and is camped, you know, a few miles ahead. And he said to me, well, we're going up tomorrow. And, you know, he didn't say I couldn't go with him. So the following morning, I helped him load up the rations and things like that. And he's just going off, and I'm climbing in the back of the truck, and he said, not you. I said, oh, I'm okay, I can go, I'm sure I can go. They've told me I could, he said he didn't. He told you if we had to go, you had to go back. Ah, well, he said, I tell you what, if you stay here, if we do come back, I'll see what we can do about it. But he said, but you can stay here with this other pile of rations, because there's still a pile of rations there, so you can act as guard of that. So they all went off, and I'm on my own now, which is okay in daylight, but it wouldn't be too good after dark. And when it was getting a bit dusk, I began to think to myself, well, if I don't go in now, I won't be able to get in overnight. I'll be here overnight, which is a bit dodgy on your own. Because, you know, if you try to get into the camp after dark, the chances are someone will shoot you. And at that moment, I saw the 1500 weight come back. And it turned around, backed up, and I thought, ah, they're coming back down for the rations again. And we loaded up the rations. And I thought, well, this is it. I've got to go now back to HQ company. And Albert came around and said, get on board. He said, I've talked to the CO, and he says you'll have your back. Fell over myself, thanking him. Got in there, went back up the company. I don't know, he said CO, but was probably the company commander he'd spoken to, in actual fact. Although I guess it would have had to have been the CO who gave permission, because I was still supposed to be on light duties. And when I got back there, they were camped on this hill, on the side of this hill, well behind the line, well behind the front line. And they'd got enormous fires going. And I rejoined the platoon, and unfortunately, John Swarbrick had just handed over to a new officer, Ralph Brown, and a new platoon sergeant, and a number of, we'd had some reinforcements. So I didn't ask him, I just took over my section, and the chap who had been running it, I think it was Biggie probably, he just went back to his section, so I took over my section again. And eventually I saw them during the day. I didn't see the platoon sergeant, but I saw the platoon commander during the day and, you know, introduced myself to him. He didn't say anything at all much. And apparently he brought a draft up and he was supposed to go back, but he'd asked permission of the CO if he could remain with the battalion. And obviously, so short of officers, permission had been given. The platoon sergeant, he was a youngish chap, but he was a wartime one, you know, when they were machine guns. And he had a fairly funny attitude, funny enough. He seemed to be ridiculing us all the time and saying, well, this career is dead easy, you know, you're a lucky chap to come out here if you've been in the war and all that. I mean, it didn't go down too well, but, you know, this sort of thing happens, you don't take it too much to heart. And we were up on this hill with these enormous great fires going. And that evening, we all sat round the fires and sang all the old songs, you know, Slow Boat to China and everything you could conceivably think of. And about 11 o'clock, when it was pretty dark, word came that we better put them out. It was quite a smashing evening. We all palled together again. And the next morning, rumours are going around that now that the Major Gwynn, is no longer CO, and a new CO has come up. Can't remember what it was, Worcester's Wiltshire, something like that. And it hits a little bit hard, because I mean, you've got trust in your own and you don't know a stranger, especially a stranger who's not fought in Korea at all, because it was an entirely different war to anything that had gone before. And we were not terribly pleased about that. We felt a bit sorry for Rowley Gwynn. In fact, he went sick shortly after that, so I guess he was a bit miffed as well. At losing the battalion, as he had every right to be. But the story was that Red Robbie Robertson, you know, the guy in Japan, had favoured one of his Lieutenant Colonels given him a battalion so he could get the medal ribbons and, you know, get a bit of service in and what have you. And poor old Rowley, who had commanded on 112 and Frog and what have you, and done so well, he was pushed back behind, and as I say, went sick and went back to Hong Kong. Anyway, it was a reasonably quiet day. The next day after I came back, it was a quietish day. We sat around, and the fires had now been put out. Funny enough, 16 Field had a troop just forward there of us right down in the valley, and we could see them. And they were firing, they were test firing in actual fact, firing actually vertically, nearly vertically up into the air, because they were trying to get shells to go just behind the back of a hill, and you know, instead of just zooming over the top and going off into space. And they were firing very, not quite vertical, but very nearly vertical. And to do this, they had to had to dig a hole out so that the breech block went down in this hole, through the trail, down into the hole, and fired nearly vertical. And we heard from them, not at this moment of time, because we heard from them on the FFOs later, that they found that the shells, when they got right up to the top, just before they began to turn over and drop down, literally like a mortar bomb now, of course. But unfortunately, up there, the air up in the extremity, the top range where it was, blew them about and blew them off target, and they could literally drop anywhere in the rear area. And of course, that wasn't much good to them, because they were into really accurate fire. And they didn't use it again. In fact, it was a couple of years later, I think, when they all tried it all again, and I presumably got the same result. And another thing was there, lifetime later, 50 years later, Ian McGibbon, their author of their history, I was talking to him about it. He said, "I've never heard of that before. Oh, what a pity. I wish I'd known that." But it was, in a sense, a failure, because they could drop them, like mortar bombs, but it couldn't get the accuracy that they desired and always looked for. I think it was the day after that, during the course of this day, incidentally, a chap named Nobby Saxby, he was from the Queen's Company, came up to us and said, "Which way round? I've got to do the notice board." Because at the moment, you see, rumours are strong that we're going back, we're going home, home is Hong Kong, of course. Going home to Hong Kong, very, very strong rumours now, getting stronger every day. And in fact, there are, you know, people are sending us out from home, bits in the paper saying that our days are numbered and it won't be long before we're relieved. And he came up, he said, "Well, I've got to build a a notice board, and I want to know which way around the marooned old gold goes." I'm afraid, to our shame, we couldn't remember. We hadn't got a berry to find out, so he said, "Oh, silly lot." I said, "Well, go over and say Cross Lawrence, he'll probably know." And he went off on his way. He was a bit shy about asking anybody in battalion quarters, because being Queens, they'd have probably taken the mickey out a little bit. I should perhaps just explain something here. We had C Company, which was known as which called themselves the Queen's Company. They come from I suppose 90% of them were Queens, and one or two were East Surreys, and they come out as a block from Germany and arrived with us 1st of October. And we'd had one or two of them been taken away and came around, and they worked in very, very well in our platoon and all the other platoons. But the block of them, I guess 100, just formed a company. We were moving, so there was no way they could do it any other way. They just formed a company, and they called themselves the Queen's Company. And I'll be honest, I suspect we those of us who have been out 1 month earlier always thought of them as the guys who came late, sort of thing, you know. But it wasn't so much an error of judgment, because there was no other way Colonel Mann could have done it, because we were moving. He had to take 100 men who knew each other and put them together. But the Argyles, when they reformed their fourth company in January 1951, they did the sensible thing and took their old C Company members and built it around that. And there wasn't this sort of rivalry that even lasts today, to be quite honest, in, you know, when you talk to people. But this Queen's Company, as they called, they themselves called themselves a Queen's Company, it wasn't really a very good move from, you know, integrating people into the battalion. all the KSLI and the South staff just came in and were Middlesex straight away, and were told they were, of course. But anyway, that's the deviation from the story. Next day, we started to move forward up, and we're now into the battles of the Fish Hills. All these hills at this time were being named. The previous valley, where they'd gone, where I'd been with malaria, they'd been trees, as I remember. Oak, for example, is the one where they'd had the little battle. They hadn't had any casualties, as far as I can remember, in this valley. And they did kill a few Chinese, but they'd done quite well. Now we come over into what we call the Kapyong Valley. The other one was the Kapyong Chon, I think. And we're going up the Kapyong Valley, and now the hills are changing from flowers, narcissi and poppy and things like that, to fish. And we're going up against, first of all, kipper, cod and dab. And the Canadians are going up against turbot and trout. They've all got fish names. We're the reserve company at this moment of time as we move up. And we stop the night about halfway up to our objective. The Australians are out ahead, Canadians are out ahead. I think the Argyles might have been as well. I can't really remember, because they'd, unfortunately, up this previous valley, they walked into the minefields and had some casualties, of which two were officers killed. And that sort of slowed them down a little bit. And the Americans had had, the engineers had had some casualties trying to clear the mines. Anyway, the Aussies were ahead of us, over the Canadians on our right. And we stopped in this lovely place. The valley opened out, and there were all stones, and the water, the stream opens out then once you get to a wide part. So the narrow stream becomes a wide, expansive water, about, oh, I don't know, a foot deep, maybe something like that. Green grass, it was a bit wet, but we did a job finding any wood for a brew fire and things. And we camped on the side of this little gully. And as we're sitting around there, we saw a section go running off at the double, looking a bit grim. And it was from 5 Platoon. I know the platoon commander. In fact, I spoke to him just recently. And he dashes off, looking a bit warlike, you know. And we didn't think anymore. About half an hour later, they came back, and they're giggling and laughing. And I went over and had a little chat with him. The basic story is, and I'm sure it's been embroidered along the way, but the company commander, he thought, well, this is a good chance to have a little bit of a strip down watch. So he'd gone away from us all behind some trees, and got undressed and was having his wash. Suddenly, somebody fires at him. A shot comes out the hills and just misses him quite easy. So he scampers back, and another couple of shots come down and see him on his way. And he wasn't too pleased about that, because it was expected that there was a Chinese sniper up there somewhere. So this section went off to up this hill. When they got over top there, they found a Maori from 16 Field with a rifle, who apparently had been out hunting. And when he'd seen this, company commander was, shall we say, compared with the rest of us, robust. He wasn't fat, but he was bigger than the rest of us, and quite a big man anyway. When he'd seen him out in his stripped-out watch, so he couldn't resist it, he fired a shot. And I think this was all kept under wraps, to be quite honest, because there's no mention of this anywhere in the war diaries. And I guess they let him off, because if they hadn't, the whole story would have come out. But I think there was a certain amount of amusement about it, though obviously you would never let the company commander know that you even knew about it.
Did you say Maori?
Maori, yeah. You know, New Zealand Maori, yeah. Yeah. I probably pronounce it wrong, because I'm an old country boy. But following morning, D Company led off, and they had Australian guides take them up the hills and pass through the Australians. We're still reserve, and that B Company is still reserve. And we went up and spent the night around battalion headquarters. I should mention here, thick fog had come down now, and nobody can see where the devil they're going. And we were encased in fog. I must say we were a little bit nervous because it seemed to us that if the fog lifted, anybody up on Kipper ahead would look straight down on us and we'd be a fairly good target to them. C Company went up on the right, I think, just on a little hill, so they were okay. And I guess as reserve, you know, we were ready to move off. Following morning, the fog cleared a little bit, lifted a little bit, and we started to go up Kipper, which was a long, lower, long sort of ridge-like, L-shaped in actual fact, though we didn't know this at the time. And gradually going up, it was obvious the Chinese had passed this way because there were odd rounds littered around, pretty ones with yellow noses and red noses and things like that. I should think they dropped off for some porter's package or other, off his A-frame or something or other, because they very rarely left ammunition about. And gradually went up reasonably slowly because there's a few shots coming in from our left flank from Cod, just whipping over, nowhere near us. And, or I say Cod, they could have come from Dab on their left flank. There's a valley in between. And gradually got up the top. The FFO must have been up ahead because he was laid down behind a tree with his two signallers, and they were directing fire onto Cod. But unfortunately, of course, there's a very accurate Chinese sniper up there who's might have been two or three of them actually, who were firing at this tree he was hiding behind, and bits were bouncing off it. And we just darted over the other side. And I can't remember. I expect the platoon commander must have told me to move forward. I can't remember if he did or not. But anyway, I'm moving up the ridge. And Ken Sutton said to me, I can tell the veterans here, because he said, you're whistling. I said, why? He said, you're whistling. I said, am I? I didn't know I was. But I wasn't a veteran. I was as scared as the rest of them. Anyway, I sent my LMG on the forward slope. I could see a trench cut out there. Sent them forward on the forward slope and joined Ken there, lying there. And I couldn't make it out because they were half in and half out of the trench. I couldn't make out why they were not in the trench, you know, not keeping down with this guy popping away at us. Very accurate, this chap was, this sniper. As I say, there might have been a couple. So I thought, well, I'd better go find out what the devil they're doing down there. So I ran forward, and when I got within about 6 foot of the trench, I took a great leap to leap into the trench, into the end of the trench, which they weren't in. And it was then I realised that it was cut out, the turf ground on the top was cut out to be about 6 foot long, but only about an inch down, and they were wedged in a little hole at the end, big enough for one man. So we're in a little bit of dire straits now, because we can see that the old sniper is going to be well pleased with us, a nice target like this. So I said to him, well, there's only one thing, we can't use this. We'll get back as quick as we can, just go fast as you can, out the trench, and go back over the ridge. And he fired a couple of shots, but nowhere near, and we went back and laid on the other side of the ridge. Now, up till now, the new platoon commander had been leading from the front, which they were always prone to do. They're not supposed to. They're supposed to be one section back, because or maybe even two sections, depending on the circumstances, but certainly one section back, section leading. But the air old hands, Chris Lowen says, always led from the front. I mean, they never change their minds. But the newer ones quite often did it right and went one section back. But he'd been leading from the front. But now he decided that he wouldn't do it.